Welcome back to Restless Viking Radio. I'm Chuck. Pull up a chair, grab some coffee. This one starts before the water, before the wind, before anyone realized we were about to find out whether the plan was enough. It starts in a small office at Grand Haven. This is Kayaking the Manitou Straits. The National Park Service office at Glen Haven sat back from the beach in a low, aging building that felt like it expected customers to wander in, asking about dock schedules and canned goods. This was not the visitor center. That had been miles away. It was where we were told to start. Someone there had leafed through a binder, made a call, and eventually admitted they weren't sure where a float plan like ours was supposed to land. And after a little back and forth, they sent us here instead. Someone at Grand Haven would know. The building smelled like old paper and wood. It wasn't run down, just tired and used. Behind the counter, a full-length scuba suit hung on a wall hook. It was black neoprene with a hood attached. It sort of looked like a person who had stepped out of the room and never returned. It didn't belong there. It felt like a warning hung where a coat rack should have been. The counter itself was scarred pine, worn smooth by decades of elbows. Maps were tacked to corkboard, their corners curling up from the pushpins. The place looked like it was once useful. The ranger looked up when I came in. He was young, with precise blonde hair, maybe in his early 20s. He had new boots and a pressed uniform. He stood the way people do when you've been trained to stand correctly. I told him I needed to file a float plan, and his expression shifted. For what? A kayak crossing, Glen Haven to South Manitou. The words took a moment to settle. He leaned back slightly, eyes drifting to the wall mat behind me, then back to my face. That's dangerous, he declared. I acknowledged it without agreeing. The Coast Guard sent me here, I said. They usually don't do that. They advertise it, I said, for kayakers. He clenched his jaw as he looked down at the clipboard on the counter. We don't really do those here, he said. Outside, the lake was invisible from the office. You couldn't hear it either. Glen Haven had a way of hiding water until you committed to it. I slid the float plan across the counter. It was clean, typed, routes marked, distances, roles assigned, communications, contingencies, alternatives. Everything was laid out. He skimmed it. His eyes moved fast. People get into trouble out there, he said, tapping the page with one finger. I'm aware. He launched into a lecture. Wind, weather, cold water, distance, rescue times. None of it was connected to the document in front of him. When he finished, I pointed to a section in the margin. It's built on the GAR model, I said. The Park Service Risk System. He paused. Just enough to replay the acronym in his head. Green, amber, red. His eyes lifted from the page and moved past me toward the laminated sign bolted to the door by the entry. It said, Kayakers, file a float plan. I followed his eyes to the sign, leaned lightly on the counter, and resisted a smile. He nodded once. Right, he said quietly. For a moment, neither of us spoke. Behind him, the scuba suit sagged slightly on its hanger. Well, he said finally, straightening a bit, you'll need park permits. They're on the truck, I said, pointing behind me. His eyes widened blankly. Then they narrowed. For camping, he clarified. Yeah. You'll need to get those before you go. We already did at the visitor center. He stopped, frozen. We're not taking the ferry, I added. He looked down at his desk, then the logbook, then back at the plan. It seemed like he was hoping for new instructions to surface. Oh, he said. The room stood still. He picked up his pen, wrote carefully, clipped the plan to the board, and made an entry in the logbook. Then he looked up and sighed. Make sure you let us know when you arrive. Thanks. I turned and pulled on the wooden door. It squeaked loudly. Have a good day, I said over my shoulder. Outside, the bay was calm. I still couldn't see the lake beyond Sleeping Bear Point, but that was okay. We weren't launching yet. As I walked back to the beach, everyone was busy organizing gear and getting kayaks from roofs. Vic paced back and forth near his boat trailer. He tossed his inflatable PFD in the boat and walked straight toward me. He wanted his large boat in the water first. There was no launch at Glen Haven, no ramp, no clean way to do it, just sand and 150 yards. I called to the others to help out. They gathered around, each finding a handhold. I hadn't realized how far it was to the beach until we were already lifting. The inflatable came off the trailer unevenly, gray fabric, wood floor, and an engine. It sagged where you expected it to be stiff and pulled where you expected it to float. The motor alone dictated how we moved. Hands searched for balance points that kept shifting. Someone adjusted their grip, and someone else swore under their breath and laughed it off. We started moving. The sand gave way under every step, not enough to stop you, just enough to make you work for each yard. The boat dragged, flexed, and twisted. I was constantly correcting as my steps staggered like I'd been drinking. It was really heavy. More like awkwardly heavy. Breathing got loud. By the time we reached the waterline, shoulders were tight and lungs were burning. We splashed and kicked, then set the boat in the water. We stood back on the sand, chests rising and falling. The lake just rested as it watched us recover. I took the expedition plan out. The paper felt light in my hands. We gathered again, closer this time. Eight of them. They had easy faces, their eyes alert. They stood with legs wide, hands on hips, or clutching their life jackets. Our breathing slowed. I laid out roles and responsibilities, who was leading, who was sweeping, who stayed if things got stretched out. Radios came up. We checked channels and adjusted volume, then compasses. I gave the bearing to South Manitou Island and waited while needles settled and heads tilted down together. The water was quiet enough that morning to make listening easy. As I talked, Kramer's kayak began to slide. It barely moved at first. Then the bow angled slightly, almost like it was checking to see if we noticed. Then the stern swung and it picked up speed. Not much, but enough. It's like it was waiting exactly for this moment. I kept talking and suddenly it was almost 25 feet out. I dropped my arms to my side and let out a breath. "Kramer," I said. He turned. Then he was in the water, grabbing the bow and dragging it back up on the sand. A couple of the team shook their heads and smiled. And the lake stayed still. Behind us, the shore looked solid and patient. Ahead, the lake stayed flat and gray, giving nothing away. The Zodiac motor roared to life. We put on spray skirts, made final adjustments, checked paddles. I stuffed fresh batteries in the GPS, just in case. Most were already sitting in their cockpits. I straddled mine, crouching. I let the silence hang for a moment. "Let's get on with it, gentlemen," I announced. Vic was already trolling far ahead, his motor spilling lazy swirls of two-cycle smoke. The soft gurgle of water folded around the paddles. The light bumps of kayak hulls were sorting themselves out. The air smelled sharp and clean, the way it does after lightning's been fighting itself all night. I scanned the shoreline from the launch to Sleeping Bear Point. Nobody walked the beach. No boats on the water. It just waited. We were a confused gaggle of kayaks, stroking and struggling to point our bows toward open water. "Well, I do declare," Papa announced in his southern gentleman voice. "The sky looks madder than a dog in a hubcap factory." My eyes narrowed on him, a smirk tugging at the corner of my mouth. I adjusted the map case and my fingers quivered. I tightened my grip and shook it out. Duck slid by me in his sleeker kayak, moving quickly, a small Detroit Red Wings flag wagging slowly on a stern. Kramer pushed the front, steady and deliberate. Wapiti smiled as he looked to the sky, then around the group, watching each kayaker ahead of him before glancing out toward Vic racing back and forth. He turned toward me and grinned wide. I couldn't tell if he was just happy to be in the water or if he was amused by Vic's energy. I nodded anyway. Sleeping Bear Point stood high, a few miles away to our left, its pale sand holding the light against the dark sky. We slid across the water easily, the formation settling in. Wapiti hung back, eyes moving constantly. I stayed mid-pack, calling out mileage, adjusting course by following the GPS. Kramer pushed the front. Duck held the left with Papa and a couple others, his flag still wagging behind him. I checked the GPS. 7.12 miles. A breeze swept across our formation. Small ripples chased it, spread in wide patterns, then flattened again. I adjusted and felt a tingle in my foot. I squinted ahead and caught what looked like a line in the water, running north to south. I fixed on it, trying to bring it into focus. I glanced back at Wapiti. Had he seen it? When I looked forward again, the distance felt wrong. The sky and water started losing their edge. "Fog," I murmured. I checked the map. Just beyond the point, the shipping lane cuts across our path. I looked up again. Vic was already farther ahead, smaller now, reduced to quick flashes of white spray on the beam. I fussed with the GPS and map more than I needed to, nudging things into place that were already fine. I shifted in the seat, scooting back and forth, pressing my feet harder into the braces, trying to find purchase that wasn't really missing. Then I paddled. We cleared the end of Sleeping Bear Point. A fog bank nosed up against it, veiling the water to the south. A breeze swept across the surface, and I felt the water begin to move. Not rough yet, just unsettled. A few strokes later, the wind picked up a slight buzz. Not strong, just persistent. Duck's little flag began to flutter. A small wave broke just ahead of me, then another off to the side. Within minutes, white caps were popping all around us as the wind rose into a steady roar. The formation loosened. Boats began to bob independently, and we paddled into them. Those without rudders worked harder to hold their line. Duck was no longer beside me. He had dropped back. I watched him paddle hard on one side, sometimes three strokes upwind before allowing a single downwind correction. Long lines of waves started to roll through. Our kayaks twitched and wiggled beneath us as we learned their rhythm, each hull answering differently, each stroke beginning to matter. Shit, I hissed through my teeth. I began paddling, eyes forward, but every few strokes I checked behind me. Duck was still there. A wave lapped over my deck. I slapped the crest with my paddle and braced. The push slid me a few feet before the energy carried on. I watched the same wave rise high enough to hide Papa's yellow and red hull completely, then settled again. Damn. I shook my head and kept my strokes firm. I looked for Vic. He was gone. Of course he was gone. Of course he was gone at this moment. Where's Vic? I yelled. Papa kept paddling. Papa! I shouted louder this time. He looked back. Where's Vic? He moved his mouth, but the wind ate his words. Waves ran between us. I shrugged and held out an open hand. It was all I had. He did the same. Of course that jackass was gone. We dug in and pulled harder. I checked behind me again. Duck was now backstroking to stay straight. Why the hell is he doing that, I thought. I turned my bow into the waves to study up to see what was going on. My kayak climbed and dropped. Off to my left, Wapiti grabbed Duck's stern and worked the little flag loose. It came free. He tossed it toward Duck and went back to heavy strokes without a pause. I turned west again as the waves the size of couches rolled through. We paddled hard for a while. Then something shifted. The waves were still coming through, but we began to meet them instead of resisting them. Timing replaced reaction. Boats stopped twitching so much and began to answer. I blew a whistle, then raised a paddle and circled it once, then pointed inward. One by one, our bows edged closer, the formation slowly realigning. Duck dug in and caught up. Wapiti slid in beside me, close enough to talk now, about 20 feet off. When a wave passed between us, his kayak vanished, and all I could see for a moment were his shoulders and head rising above the water, then the boat again, as a wave moved on. He grinned at me, breathing hard, and pointed back at Duck. The flag was acting as a sail, he said. He described his diagnosis and solution with a satisfied smile. I nodded. We held that spacing and found a rhythm. It wasn't calm, and it wasn't really easy, but it felt workable. We matched those waves and let the kayaks do what they were built to do. After a few minutes, Wapiti eased back into the sweeper position without being asked. It was just where he belonged. I stayed mid-pack, checking bearings, counting. I let the work settle into my shoulders. And that's when I heard it, low at first, distant. A drawn-out rumble threading its way through the wind. It didn't rise or fall, just stayed there, steady and heavy. Like something enormous was moving across the land. A freight train, I wondered. I listened for it again. The same long, continuous sound in the same direction. Must be on shore. We were 4 miles out by now, close to 5 from the island. The map in my head didn't argue. The sound didn't either. It just kept coming, sliding under everything else. We paddled on. My chest hitched with the realization. Shipping lane. Not something small, not something fast. A freighter. 1,000 feet of steel moving somewhere behind us, its body erased by the fog. Its sound arriving ahead of it like a warning sent early. I looked for a wake. There wasn't one. Just the sound, low, continuous, close enough to matter. I glanced back at the others, then forward into the gray. There was no hull, no wake, no confirmation, just sound. I kept paddling. Off to my north, a certainty began to form that there was land there. It didn't arrive all at once. It just eased in the way a presence does when you stop paying attention to the room. I couldn't see anything. There was nothing to see. My body started to behave as if it were true. Not open water, but shoreline, trees, a low spit of land reaching out farther than the map allowed. Not imagined in detail, just assumed. Something solid, fixed, close. It felt real enough to lean against. For a moment, my shoulders dropped. The world began to make sense again. I knew better. I knew what the map said. I knew there was nothing there. The sound still rumbled in and out, whatever it was. The wind howled and the waves heaved past. I checked the GPS. The screen blinked once, then again. Then it went blank. No warning, no drama, just gone. I looked at it longer than I needed to, as if waiting might bring it back. It didn't. The unit stayed dark in its mount. I picked it up, my hips wiggling in the chop. Pressed the power button, nothing. I had spare batteries in the rear compartment, but that was impossible in these seas. I dropped it to the deck, it slid into the water, and the lanyard caught it. I picked it out of the water and slid it under a bungee. Then I pulled the map case toward me a little and exposed my deck compass. I felt the weight of it for a second. Not panic, just the quiet subtraction of something I'd been leaning on without realizing it. I checked the map to get a couple of bearings from land, and the land was gone, shrouded by a milky wall of mist. I looked at the map, the bearing line, 345 degrees. No landmarks anywhere, just riding the compass. The needle held steady, no sway, no movement. I looked over at Papa. His bow was off. He was pointing too far north. Papa, I called out as I pulled strokes to get closer. Yo, you're too far north, I called, asking as much as telling. He looked at me, then leaned forward to see his compass. 345 degrees, he called back, giving a knife hand in the direction of travel. I checked my compass. It pointed in another direction, 20 degrees further south. He shook his head and kept pointing. My eyes narrowed on my compass. The needle didn't move as my bow rotated in his direction. It was locked for some reason. Then the GPS slid a bit, freeing the compass, and the numbers settled. I swept the GPS off the deck into the water and let it drag beside me. It's frickin' waterproof, I growled. Behind me, boats rose and fell into sequence. Ahead, nothing but gray. The sound sometimes rolling on through the wind. We paddled. Time loosened. An hour, maybe. The white vapor around us thinned and began to glow. Not brighter exactly, just lighter, as if the air itself were easing up. The water stayed dark. The waves kept their shape. Then something changed ahead. Not land yet, just a difference. A small interruption in all that gray. Then the sun broke through in a narrow beam and fell on it, isolating the shape and everything around it. And then I saw it. A white point. Impossibly small. Like the tip of a toothpick held out at arm's length. Not the whole thing, just the tip. It was sharp and clean and too bright for its size. Once you saw it, you couldn't unsee it. The lighthouse. Still an hour away. Close enough for the sun to find it. Far enough to feel unlikely. I think that's the lighthouse, I called as a wave washed over the deck. Eyes narrowed, postures leaned forward in hope. Above the island, a cloud towered. Blackness swirled like twisting dark ice cream. Then a flash in that thickness that spread across the sky. And soon after, a quiet, low rumble, like a freight train in the distance. My shoulders were a tired, aching mass. My right foot needled and seemed to close in on itself. I smiled a little. And then the waves started to settle, not all at once, but slowly, like they felt just as tired as we did. Occasionally, one would heave a last surge and then spread out. The wind had decided it had someplace else to be. The flashes in the clouds made me wonder if I should have my paddle in the water. By the time people on shore became visible, watching us from the lighthouse and the beach, the lake was already deciding it was done with us. A lone American flag fluttered above the trees as we worked around Sandy Point into the harbor. I think that's the ranger station, I called to Papa. No dog tags today, he called back. That's a good day, I smirked. The harbor opened up like it stopped holding its breath. One moment chaos, the next glass. The ferry sat at the dock, calm and unimpressed. Vic was already there, inflatable tied off, waiting like he'd never doubted the timing. We landed, each kayak whooshing as it hit the sand. I pulled my skirt, nearly fell over. My leg was completely numb. I looked around. Everybody was busy organizing or pulling their legs from the kayak. I paused for a minute to let the blood flow. Then I stood. I walked toward the lighthouse trail to get my leg back to normal. Wapiti and Papa casually followed as the rest continued reorganizing their gear. The volunteer lighthouse keeper was walking toward us. You the kayakers? He demanded. I looked down at the spray skirt I was wearing. Papa didn't hesitate. Yeah, who's asking? The keeper made it to us without saying a word. He appraised our kayaks in the distance, then looked at each of us. You guys deserve the Darwin Award for that stunt. We watched him go as he hurried for the dock. The sky rumbled hard. We grabbed some gear from the kayaks and started for the dock as the air started to feel excited. Then a flash and a loud crack. The sky opened up and poured needling rain on us. We trotted faster toward the open boathouse as the rain started flattening everything. We snickered as we made it inside, all nine of us. The short ranger looked at us with a furrowed brow. You missed the orientation, she said. Where have you been? I stared at her, her socks pulled tight to her knees, spotless hiking boots, ranger hat worn like a drill sergeant. Wapiti glanced at me with a look that asked if he was hearing the same thing I was. We just got here, I said. She shook her head. No, you didn't. She said it the way rules get said when they've already failed. I looked past her toward the harbor. The kayaks were lined up, bright colors against the sand, gear stacked on the decks, exactly where we'd left them. A smirk crept in before I could stop it. Behind us, the lake had gone flat. The storm moved on. The crossing was already over. I didn't argue. The lake didn't either. It didn't care. But it let us go. There's a difference between being witnessed and being believed. We spend a lot of time chasing belief, explaining, proving, lining up facts, hoping someone nods at the right moment and says, yes, that counts. But witness is quieter than that. Witness is the person who was there, the body that felt it, the mark left behind after the effort stopped. The lake doesn't believe you. It doesn't argue with you either. It just knows whether you crossed or not. We've all had our crossings. The work happens, the crossing happens, and later someone might question it, misunderstand it, or miss it entirely. That doesn't undo the crossing. Being believed is optional, but being witnessed is not. Sometimes the only thing that sees what you carried is the thing that let you set it down. Sometimes you don't get applause. Sometimes you don't get belief. Sometimes all you get is the thing itself, the wind, the work, the weight, and the quiet after. And that's enough. This is Restless Viking Radio. We'll see you next week.